This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double. Clap your hands.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Breakfast on Tuesday, the 15th of July, 2025. And thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and in the studio today, we've got Fiza and Juliet. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
How is everyone going this week?
Yeah, it's good. It's good to be back.
Yeah, welcome back, Fiza.
Yeah, finally out of my PhD brain headspace. I went to the Carlo exhibition in Bendigo. It was the final weekend. Yeah, it was really nice. Yeah, it was good to get out of the city for a bit. Yeah.
Can you describe it a bit for our listeners?
Frida Kahlo's exhibition.
Yeah, in terms of like what was it like her entire sort of life?
Yeah, so it was a bit autobiographical as well. And like, it was interesting because it was obviously a lot more about who she was and how she was photographed by others. But also, yeah, like they did share quite a bit of her artwork. And they just had this like massive prints of her in her, you know, rebozo and her traditional, the Tijuana dresses that she likes to wear like on the wall. So like literally larger than life Frida Kahlo's on the wall. And a lot of the women showed up dressed up as well, like they had the flowers in their hair and everything, which was really nice. So yeah, no, it was good.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. And nice to see a show like out of the city.
Exactly.
Like leave Melbourne.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Art takes place outside of Melbourne too, guys.
Exactly. And did you learn anything interesting about Frida Kahlo's life that you didn't know beforehand?
Oh, she, like, I always kind of knew that about her, like, she had all these, like, animals that she always hung out with, but there was, like, a whole wall dedicated to, like, Frida Kahlo and all these different animals, which is amazing. There was this beautiful one of her with a deer that was, like, literally in her arms and she was just holding it. It was, yeah, she's just, there's something very ethereal and magical about her energy. Yeah, no, it was gorgeous.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for that.
Yeah, I feel sad to hear this raving exhibition review and I haven't made.
Yeah. Did you say it's over now?
Yes, yeah, sorry. Okay. It ended on
We're
Sunday.
Too late, Juliet.
Yeah, yeah.
That's okay. We can, Fiza, you can just give us a very detailed
Yes, I'll tell you
review.
More.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Well, let's have a chat about what is coming up on today's show. So we start off with a two-part conversation that I had with Renee Ha, who is the founder and project coordinator of Stamped Zine, which is a project written by and for migrants and visa holders in so-called Australia. So we spoke yesterday about their final edition of the zine called Departure and talk about some of the themes that came from the works featured in this project. So looking at things like visa insecurity, the way in which migrants and international students are regarded in Australia, and the struggles that migrants face here to do with like work and housing and so on. So that's coming up at 7:15 and at 7:30.
Beautiful. And then at 7:45, we'll be joined by Isabella Reneke from Greta Fund, and she'll be speaking about the Australian climate case, which is really, really exciting. That's a landmark climate case, and the decision will be handed out today at 2 p.m. at the Australian Federal Court. Yeah, so it's essentially Uncle Pabai and Uncle Paul have been pushing against the Australian federal government, saying that it owes a duty of care to protect Torres Strait Islanders. So whatever the outcome is today will have a massive impact on future legislation movements.
Yeah, all very timely. And at 8 a.m., we are speaking to Farida Iqbal from the Defend Dissent Coalition. So we'll be chatting about the proposed protest laws here in Victoria, and particularly the impact of a ban on the use of face masks and what that's going to mean for public health and safety.
Absolutely. And finally, at 8:15, we'll be joined by Sarah Barini speaking about the convergence on Canberra that's happening this Sunday through to next Tuesday, demanding the Liberal government to end its support and complicity in the genocide in Gaza.
So we've got a huge show for our listeners this morning, so stay tuned and we'll be back with the news headlines right after this.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty, say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital and online at 3cr.org.au. And here are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 15th of July, 2025. Wurundjeri, the world's largest rock art site located on the Burrup Peninsula in Western Australia, was officially confirmed as a cultural world heritage site at the 47th World Heritage Committee at the UNESCO headquarters in Paris late last week. Wurundjeri was listed with an amendment by UNESCO member states for the Australian government to continue research and monitoring of industrial impacts on the site. And this is reference to the impacts of pollution from Woodside's Northwest Shelf LNG processing facility, which research has shown is accelerating the weathering and degradation of the over 1 million petroglyphs which make up this globally significant rock art site. According to Save Our Songlines, the amendment revoked the essential requirement for decommissioning and rehabilitation of existing harmful industry impacting the site, removed the critical recommendation regarding no further expansion of industry, and replaces with a recommendation that enables further industrial expansion. It also deleted the critical requirement for removal of harmful acid gas emissions and failed to require best practice technology and regulations in the control of industrial emissions affecting Wurundjeri. Also in the news, an investigation by Al Jazeera's Sanad Investigations Unit has found that demolition operations being conducted by Israel in Rafah have been stepped up sharply. Israel's Defence Ministry has announced a plan to relocate 600,000 people into what observers say would be concentration camps in the area in southern Gaza, with plans to expand this to the Strip's entire population. Sanad's analysis of satellite imagery up to July 4th shows the number of demolished buildings in Rafah rising to about 28,600, up from 15,800 on April 4 of this year, according to data from the United Nations Satellite Center. This means that approximately 12,800 buildings were destroyed between early April and early July alone, a marked acceleration in demolitions that has coincided with Israel's new push into Rafah, launched in late March of this year. Philippe Lazzarini, the head of the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA, which has been banned by Israel, warned against the latest mass forced displacement plan. He said this would de facto create massive concentration camps at the border with Egypt for the Palestinians displaced over and over across generations. He also added that it would deprive Palestinians of any prospects of a better future in their homeland.
In other news this week, South Korea has introduced new age-based employment laws which could have negative impacts for older workers, according to a report by Human Rights Watch. The new legislation allows both the public and private sector to adopt mandatory retirement ages, of 60 or older. The South Korean government has also introduced a peak wage system which enables employers to reduce the wages of its employees in the 3 to 5 year period before their mandatory retirement age. Human Rights Watch concluded that the new legislation could constitute discrimination towards older workers. The report also found that workers over the age of 60 were earning on average close to a third less than younger workers, and that when re-employed in new roles, they were focused in lower paid occupations. Bridget Sleep, the senior researcher at Human Rights Watch, determined South Korea's age-based employment laws and policies discriminate against older people and future generations. The government needs to adopt a comprehensive anti-discrimination law to fight all forms of discrimination, including ageism and discrimination based on age. And finally, in the headlines, last week the Victorian government announced that it would permit recreational deer hunting in East Gippsland National Parks. The existing Great Alps National Parks Management Plan does not currently permit deer hunting, and the Victorian Protected Areas Council highlights that this decision that they've made requires an amendment to the National Parks Act of 1975. The council also points out that recreational hunting is not recommended in the state government's own East Gippsland Victoria Deer Control Plan 2023 to 2028. The president of the Victorian Protected Areas Council, Felicity Brooke, commented that feral deer control is vital, but it needs to be carefully planned, managed, and timed. We encourage the Victorian government to reconsider this decision and focus on properly funded and managed feral deer control in our national parks while considering the enjoyment of parks by visitors. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 15th of July, 2025, and you're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! 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 3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now. Step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop black deaths in custody.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, 3CR Digital and 3cr.org.au. Stamped Zine is a project made by migrants for migrants. It is edited by a group of creatives who have been navigating so-called Australia as foreigners for some time. And the goal of the zine is to create a space for visa holders to express both the mundane and the aspirational while trying to settle temporarily. It's a place to protest without the shame of needing to be grateful or being told that you should return to your homeland. Yesterday, I spoke to Stamped Zine's founder and project coordinator, Renee Ha, who describes themselves as a former cash cow and was based in Gadigal land with a keen interest in identity making in the context of ethno-nationalism and post-colonial effects. They have recently relocated to their home city of Ho Chi Minh City. We spoke about the fourth and final edition of the zine called Departure and the complexities of the migrant experience in so-called Australia. Here is part one of the conversation.
My name is Renee Ha, and I am speaking to you in Ho Chi Minh City as I was departing from Gadigal land, aka Sydney, just a couple of days ago. So I'm here as Stamped Zine's project coordinator and founder. So it's been quite a pleasure to be back here again. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so you've just released your fourth and final edition of Stamped Zine, this one being called Departure. How would you summarize this edition for listeners, and how does it differ from previous editions?
So Departure is our fourth, which is quite a cute number, I would say. It feels a bit full. I mean, I like three more, but four, it's okay. I like an even number. And I guess it's kind of like a very poignant kind of chapters to the themes that we would like to explore on immigration, because the very first edition we had was called Limbo. And then from Limbo, we're trying to explore with window of opportunity, on, you know, when you've got the chance to cross the border. Third one being like Between Worlds, which is about the struggle to maintain, you know, like where's your life exactly is. And the final as Departure, it feels like kind of like a complete cycle on how we set out the themes. Because I guess for me as well, as someone who's lived on a visa, like it needs to have an end eventually, is how I say it. And when I penned Departure, I mean, it is also like personal to me because I guess I founded the project, right? And also this is due to like a very pragmatic logistic issues, because if I'm not around in the city, how would the project continue to operate as well? And to find someone to step in, frankly, I haven't really had a chance or luck to find someone who have the same capacity that I can offer for this sort of project. And so Departure is kind of an interesting one, because when I emailed the organizers, the editors, they were trying to press me like, oh, so this Departure thing, like, what do you mean? Where do you depart from? And I was like, I kind of want to keep it as an open end thing. I mean, because we have two locations. Yeah, most people have those two locations, right? The place that they came from and the place that they lived in. And so I was like, it could be either or. It could be just like from leaving the home country or leaving Australia. And so this edition has that sort of very good mix of people who share their stories on how they felt when they left the home country, and also some like me as well, leaving Australia for their own reasons. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think you've covered a lot of things just now in your answer that I want to touch on. But I think one of the major things that I wanted to ask you about was visas and that theme of security or lack thereof. That's something that stood out for me as I was reading this edition, that there was that discussion of like an expiry date of coming to an end and instability. I think Hal in their piece writes that realization leaves me in an almost permanent state of anticipatory grief. And yeah, I couldn't help but feel that sort of constantly thinking about security and visas and things coming to an end throughout the piece. So yeah, I was wondering, you know, as someone who has been in so-called Australia on a visa, the types of discussions that you have had with other visa holders and your experience yourself living, creating, working, whilst having this sort of expiration date loom over you.
So the thing about visas is that let's just to be frank and acknowledge how complex the colonial border is. Australia is so easily one of like the most complex visa systems that would have like around the globe. And the thing is that the visa is a very specific sort of category because I mean, the same thing with people as well. And when you're trying to manage people in like such a micromanaging way, like it gets so difficult. And to be upfront as well, most of the contributors and even myself including, like we are mostly under the same visa category, which international students. There would also be like very vastly different circumstances where we have refugees coming in or skilled workers or, you know, people, you know, tourists is the type of visa as well. Each of us got to be very clear about our intention of entering. And that sort of declaration has been quite a pain point because like human movements, you cannot quite tell if you come to a land and you need to be like, okay, I know what is the exact date I need to leave, right? And especially now with the expiration date kind of thing, it's like, oh, the idea of the expiration date is so interesting because like it seems to be a kind of like future prediction type of thing. It's like you need to have the end date. It's the same thing when you have like a pre-packaged food and you have expiration date. And we always ask ourselves like, is the food still available after that date or like is it off? And it's the same thing with us as well. We're like we're humans, we're just like the same organic pack of meat in a sense. Like if the expiration date hits, like are we going off or like what's the thing here? Like why do we need to be expired, right? And so it's just kind of like funny to have that like looming over your head constantly because being like, so for my case, I've been saying goodbyes to my friends since 2019. Every year, it's kind of like, I cannot promise that I'm going to go back because most of the time, it's not just about the visa. It's also because of the legal status you're in. As foreigners, we have a very different sort of housing market to get access to, different employment landscape, even in higher education that we probably know about. And so to navigate all that, it's not just like, oh, if you're legal, you probably can stay. Like, no, there is like a myriad of other things that you need to encounter. Because like, I am bitter because again, like the project started just because when I apply for job applications, they all say Australian only. And I hate it to my guts. And so it's all kind of related. And I don't know how that I kind of juggle it. I end up become like this permanent annoyance to most of my friends. Like it took for a while and I can only have this sort of conversations mostly with my high school friends from Vietnam because like majority of us also went overseas as well. We get to access it. Some of them became citizens, some of them came back and kind of like try to hustle just like me. And to talk about this with my local Australians, like whether if they're white or from like a close immigration background, I mean, they can only, you know, like anti-racism, but like visa is a very, very specific one, like a very extremely specific one, like to the point where I remember telling a friend of mine where they be like, my parents, they came from the Philippines in like the 90s for work. And they're like, ha, I'm actually related to your parents more than you, just so you know. So yeah.
That's what came through with each story, with each image and piece of art was that like, there are so many layers, complex layers to this experience of being a migrant here in so-called Australia and having to navigate visas, just even like the concepts of like colonial borders, having to navigate like housing, work, study. And yeah, there was a great line in Amandi's piece. They wrote, any second now someone may appear to take our mugshots and ask us where we were the night of the great Australian housing crisis. We've been listening to part one of a conversation I had with Renee Ha, who is the founder and project coordinator of Stamped Scene, and we were talking about their latest edition, Departure. Before we play part two of the interview, we'd like to share a song, and the lyrics of this song are published in this edition of the zine. So this song is by Su An, and it's called Chinese New Year.
It's Chinese New Year.
Was the song Chinese New Year by Su An, who is one of the contributors of the fourth edition and the final edition of Stamped Zine called Departure. We are going to play part two now of my conversation with Renee Ha, who is the founder and project coordinator of this zine. I wanted to go back to something that you said earlier about being truthful and having to state, you know, your intentions before coming here and almost like knowing the future. And another thing that came up was the expectations of like migrants as well, held to, you know, such a high standards to everyone else. I think there were stories about queer migrants who often have their personal lives and their romantic lives like scrutinized. And as someone who's like a citizen, like you wouldn't ever even have to think about that because that's your private life. You know, why does the state need to invade your personal life like that? So yeah, there's just like so many layers there, but like they do come through the writing. I'm wondering what reflections you had as you were like editing and putting together this piece in terms of like the spectrum of experiences, but also like the commonalities that came through as well.
I can be completely honest that we don't often have that many submissions. Most of the time people submit to us and we tend to take them in as is. I only disqualify them if they never really had to cross a border, because there would be some tensions within the editorial process, I would admit, just because sometimes I can bypass if we're not too provocative about the issue. But the thing about this project and why it provokes on people is because I do have to admit that it's rather sensitive to like its territory of become political. Like we will all get it. Like the things that we do, arts and culture, especially when you being scrutinized like that, it gets risky. And that's why I'm really treading on and really made everyone to be aware, like, okay, this project, it's small enough. You can remain anonymous if you feel safe to, but I need to ask for your consent about the risk awareness, just because so far every visa holders, when we trying to finish up the paperwork, there would be this last page called kind of like a characteristic kind of commitment where we have to adhere to the Australian value to have a fair go. And so I've done my visa like 3 times in total. And every single time I got through that page, there will be this one little line that feels very funny being like, you should not participate or incite public discord. For instance, freedom fighting, protest, stuff like that. And so it's kind of like a bit of a warning. I mean, it's not illegal. Like it's not that we not, you know, cannot participate because this is a democracy after all, right? But there are lines to tread when you try to, you know, like give it a nudge, be like, psst, hey, can we advocate for ourselves kind of conversation? And so because of that, a lot of migrants, if they are aware, we got to self-censor ourselves a lot. And the weight of our personal life as well, like some people, especially even if they could or not, moving to like partnership visa, for instance, or wedding visa, they always have to be like, proof that the love is authentic. And I was having like dinner with like a bunch of my also Vietnamese friends as well. Like each of us has very different circumstances in the country, and we were joking like, well, so who's gonna marry a local and like save us in, you know, because like maybe marrying seems to be the easiest way with like so many services we kind of have. And I thought to myself, you know what, maybe love might make me legal. But in a sense, it's kind of funny because like, why should it be that sort of like romantic and sexual relationship? Why can't my friends vouch for me? Like, what if I have a petition of like 10 local Australians sign me up and they're like, hey, I can vouch for this individual that can get in the borders, like they fine.
It makes me think of just like exactly what you said before about like the last line of the visa application, you know, do you swear that you will live by the quote unquote Australian values? Like, because we know that when they say Australian values, they're talking about like the colony, those values. Gone. Yeah.
They realize, yeah, you got a chance, mate. You got a mateship. Oh, that's my favorite, mateship.
Yeah. So it's like, it's, will you uphold, you know, the values of the colony? And then, you know, which sort of pushes you to, yeah, like you said, self-censor, and, you know, we get the creation of like the model minority and having to assimilate into the colony. And then, you know, your point just now about like how come friendships and other forms of non-romantic relationships aren't valued in the same way. Why does it always have to head towards traditional heteronormative relationships? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. What's the economic value or worth of this relationship? How is this relationship going to then benefit the economy or the colonial project? So what I discovered through reading this edition is, like, once you start pulling one of the threads that's presented to you within these stories, like, you just realize, like, the whole system is just very fraught and not grounded in anything to do with fairness or equality or opportunity or anything like that.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a bit of a pain because nation states and borders for most places, unironically, I'm saying that Western nations is easier to get in just because maybe they compensate for the atrocities that they committed. That's why I tend to joke like, hey, anyone want to marry me and I can provide you a Vietnamese citizen kind of title? Not guaranteed. Maybe my government depends. It's probably much more ludicrous than Australia, but still it's this kind of like parallel process on how we treat people and we treat them as a package, you know, just imported goods. You need to check up the standards and that's pretty much it. And I guess like the pain in here is that because it's legal and so it's deemed to be moral. And we see the sentiment a lot with the tension with, you know, people who really want to come into like new country where they like, I would be serving this place because I picked this place. And it's a fairly normative sentiment. Like, I kind of get it because it's still like a place that you live, right? You don't want to think yourselves like contributing to this evil project. It's a bit of a burden and I kind of get it. And so you remember like where those posters of Australian with like so much impact into that one. There's an excellent article written about this ages ago that I read. But essentially, that sort of tensions of, you know, racial category, citizenry, all of that sort, it gets very overwhelming. And I mean, because I had a chance to study deeply about this, but to communicate back to like, you know, audience that much more think about their very dire situation, like it doesn't really feel fair to tell them like, hey, you should know the right words to describe how you're feeling. And so that's why Stamped, in a sense, is more like an outlet, because I know it gets lonely. And I do have like, you know, comments here and there, people be like, well, it's been like a great solace to find this project, just because usually we don't want to be the ungrateful migrants. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, my final question for you, Renee, today is, you've just said that a lot of people have found this project to be comforting in some ways and allowed them maybe to be seen or their experiences reflected in a lot of this writing. And if you think about the types of stories that do get to be told in places like Australia, from my experience, you know, you don't often see the stories of people who are visa holders or in precarious situations like this. So yeah, I was wondering if you had any final thoughts now that you've wrapped up your final edition of Stamped, what reflections you have in terms of like what stories are told and what stories are published and are circulated.
So as a nerd of my own major in internet information system, this bleeds onto not just media publishing, but also in governance, academia, the same thing, is the racial hierarchy that we have that limits us a lot on who gets to be visible. And language becomes most contested ground, because I know that I get the access just because I can be this fluent. I can get the references. I can assimilate so well to the point where if I somehow slip my Vietnamese, I have like a slight panic for some reason. I was like, oh, I out myself. But that's why when I made this zine, like the first thing I thought to me, like, I need to make it as multilingual as possible. Like sometimes so far we only have, I guess, Vietnamese and Chinese being the most of it, which just seem to be like the main demographic of people we can connect to, which is a bit of a shame if we can't expand more. But it's quite a process to have this sort of diversity, and it's a lot of work, but because it's a lot of work because we haven't been able to be supported through the process at first place, right? And so language becomes such a fragile kind of tool for you to get to reach someone like, hey, would you willing to hear me out? Because most of the time you will try to work with people where the English is not quite good. I mean, like that's the biggest thesis for whenever people met me. They're like, oh my God, your English is so good. You're an international student. I'm like, bro, this is a bit about class too, but anyway, this is definitely a different day. But in the end for these stories, I guess is that I do take a lot of inspirations from grassroots organizations and people that has been existing. For instance, I absolutely admire the work of Marken Center, that's actually based in Melbourne, that they do a lot of like information dropped off about labor issues for migrants. And several organizations also based in the UK here and there, but for the Australian landscape specifically, yeah, like there is a severe lack of it. And that's why somehow this zine project kind of escaped on the scale that I did not really anticipate. Even though it's still small, but it's still kind of like, it's a painful niche, I would say. But yeah, that's pretty much it.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Renee. If listeners would like to read this edition of Stamped Departure, as well as the three other editions that you've released, where can they go to find them?
So a lot of our zines are made available online for free and access. However, I know the project is closed, but we would like to keep it permanent for everyone to have a read and a point of reference. So we have a website, which is stampedzine.wordpress.com. It mostly has everything on it, as I will gradually archive everything on that website, because our social media is a bit, you know, like it's still there for show most of the time. But the website is where you can find everything on there.
That was an interview with Renee Ha about the complexities of the migrant experience in so-called Australia. And then we discussed during our interview the themes of visa precarity, safety and self-advocacy in their fourth and final edition of their zine, Departure. To learn more about the project and to access all editions of the zine, go to stampedzine.wordpress.com. And that's Stamped, spelled S-T-A-M-P-E-D. You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast. We're going to play another song for you now. This is by Christine Arnoux, and it's her song, Island Home.
Six years.
That was My Island Home by Christine Anu, and a very appropriate song as we go into our next segment. A judgment in Uncle Pabai and Uncle Paul's landmark climate case will be handed down at 2 p.m. today. Australia's federal court will determine if the government owes a duty of care to protect Torres Strait Islanders who are at risk of becoming displaced by rising seas. Uncle Pabai and Uncle Paul, their communities and their legal team have fought for justice with courage and determination for more than 4 years. We are joined today by Isabel Reneke. She's an expert in the intersection of the law, politics and power, and the executive director and founder of Greta Fund, which has been supporting the Australian climate case. Isabel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. How are you this morning? You must be really excited. I saw your post yesterday about Decision Eve.
Yes. Yeah, I think definitely mixed bag, excited, determined.
Yeah. I guess to start us off, maybe share with our listeners, what is the Australian climate case, essentially?
It's a landmark case that's been brought by Uncle Pabai and Uncle Paul, who live in top western islands of the Torres Strait, against the Australian government, arguing that they have failed to do the things reasonably necessary to prevent climate change from destroying the Torres Strait. That really means a duty of care, and so they're arguing that there is a new duty of care and also that the government failed to do it, so failed to protect the Torres Strait appropriately.
Yeah, and what has been the impact of this? Because obviously we are seeing articles recently. We've had our first climate refugee, and impact on island customs as well, I believe. Yeah, could you share more about that?
Yeah, the impact of climate change is really profound in the Torres Strait, especially in those top western islands, which are only about a metre and a half above sea level. And that's because sea levels are rising globally due to climate pollution. And as those sea levels rise, they're actually rising at double the rate of most of the world around the Torres Strait. And what that means is seasons are changing, islands are eroding. I mean, at King Tide, kids are walking to Australian schools through knee-deep water. Flooding. It's pretty shocking, and really the trajectory that we're on would see the uncles and their communities being forced to leave their islands in our lifetimes, which is pretty terrifying.
Absolutely. And I guess that's part of why, but could you share more, because this has very much been framed as, you know, a historic landmark case with a lot of possibilities in terms of legal precedents. Could you share more about that?
Yeah, so it's modelled, this case is modelled on one of the most successful climate cases in global history, which was in 2015, an environmental group called the Agenda Foundation. They supported about 900 Dutch people to bring a similar negligence case against their government. And the court there ordered the Dutch government to cut climate pollution much more quickly than they had been planning to. And that case led to the rapid closure of coal-fired power stations and actually also led to billions of euros of investment in renewable energy and energy efficiency measures. So its impact in the Netherlands was really profound, and it got the potential to do the same in Australia.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I guess what are the possible outcomes of this hearing? You know, what could a full win mean? What could be the, longer-term impact be?
The case is massive, and there are lots of potential outcomes. And in fact, the judge said on the last day of hearing, so I'll never forget, that he didn't think he'd ever heard a case with so many contested, complex elements.
I can imagine.
So gives you an idea of how big today's going to be. But at the highest order of a win, it would look like the court agreeing that the government is negligent and has a duty of care that it's failed in the Torres Strait, and then order the government to take steps to prevent climate change from getting worse and to protect and support communities to adapt better to climate change in the Torres Strait. And what that would mean in Australia, preventing climate change in Australia, our proportion and our element of contribution to climate change would mean reducing emissions in line with science, which is cutting climate pollution by 75% this decade. The Climate Council has mapped pathways for how that's possible. That sounds like an unachievable goal compared to our current 43%, but it's not, and it's something that can be done reasonably by a government that's actually trying to take care of the people that it represents. So that's the highest order win, but there are a whole bunch of other possibilities as well. And I think, you know, the thing that I'm really proud of and excited about with this case is, aside from what happens at 2 o'clock today, this is the first time that a court has really had to reckon with the science of climate change, its impacts on Australian people in the Torres Strait, and also consider whether the Australian government is really negligent as a whole in its approach to climate change. And that in itself is a really important part of the legal journey and accountability, is actually airing the facts, making sure that the court actually understands. And we'll either have a big win today or it'll be a stepping stone to a future win. I'm quite sure of that.
Absolutely. And I think that's incredible. And I think, that's absolutely why I wanted you to come on the show and speak about it, because I feel like not enough people actually know about it. Like, even I found out about it quite recently and I realised that it's actually been going on for years now. Something that was interesting that, sorry, I just noticed this when I was looking at your profile the other day. Someone asked a very interesting question about, questions of Indigenous sovereignty in relation to engaging with the court. Could you share more, a little bit more about that? Because I find that interesting as well, because obviously,
Someone asked the other day on social media, how does this work for the uncles and sovereignty? And, I should say I'm not a First Nations person, and I definitely am not speaking for the uncles and not pretending to speak for any First Nations person, but speaking as a person who's non-Indigenous person who works with First Nations people to try and utilise the potential power of courts. It's a really fraught and kind of complicated and personal decision for people whether they want to engage with the court in this way. One thing that's really important to say is that sovereignty isn't ceded, and it's not ceded by engaging with the court process in this way. And for communities who do decide to use the court in this way to hold the government accountable, we're also dealing with the reality that, our court system has and continues to let down First Nations communities and marginalised people. And it's my belief as a lawyer, though, that we've got to push the law to make it do better. And I feel very grateful to the uncles and their communities, because what they're doing by pushing the court and pushing the law forward in this case is really making the country better for all of us.
Yeah,
I think they're very aware of that leadership role that they have.
Yeah, and it's inspiring as well, I think, to really, take this to the government as, I think I particularly like the idea of duty of care. I think that phrase is so powerful, because it's not just about, I think a lot of times the climate tends to be around economics and your financials and stuff like that. But in this case, I think, I believe one of the things you mentioned, like a possible outcome would be compensation in relation to loss of island custom. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the court is considering whether cultural loss caused by things other than the forcible removal of people's land, which is kind of how the native title system works, whether that's also compensatable. So the idea that the government has caused climate harms, which are going to force the loss of island custom or island custom in the Torres Strait, whether that can be compensated. And that could be really significant if it gets up, because it would mean that there is an argument that the government could be held responsible in court for financial compensation where its policies have caused some severing for First Nations people with their culture. So I'll be really watching that piece of the puzzle closely. And there are lots of different threads like that that we're really going to be looking at closely today and figuring out what they mean for what comes next as well.
Absolutely incredible. I think that's about all the time we have, Isabel. But is there anything else you think our listeners should know, how people can continue to support these efforts?
Absolutely. There are a couple of things. One thing is as a lawyer nerd, I wanted to say to people that, I know the courts can be kind of a bit of a intimidating, confusing sort of thing, but the thing that's really important to know about the way that the law works and the courts work is that they provide stepping stones in every judgment, the next judgments and the judgments that come. And I really do believe the facts of climate change are so clear and so profound that the law will adapt. And we've just got to find out today whether the court's going to make that step today or not yet. Yeah. And in terms of how people could support, jump on the Australian Climate Case website, australianclimatecase.org.au. You can find the Murucal Mill Steeper statement, which is a statement of solidarity with the uncles. That'll also mean you can stay in the loop and also feel free to support financially or through other campaign solidarity activities, because this fight will continue after today. Really, this is just the starting point of the next phase.
Yeah, absolutely. And what an incredibly exciting start. I'm looking forward to 2 p.m. and all fingers and toes crossed for you.
Thank
and
you
everyone
so
in your team. Thank you so much, Isabel.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. We've been speaking to Isabel Reneke from Greta Fund, speaking to us about the Australian Climate Case. Follow at Australian Climate Case on Instagram or australianclimatecase.org.au for updates, including the live stream of the decision that's coming later this afternoon.
And up next, we're going to listen to a song, Hold Strong, by Miesha, who's an Anu and Torres Strait Islander woman and singer-songwriter, sticking with this musical theme.
And if you write it, or if you don't, I forgave all of my ghost. The end of a word's already wrong before it makes soon. The history that you're both up speaking or up and out of the roads. See, I could be the
My name is Miss Kinana. I'm a proud Yoruba, Jajarong, Kalkadoon, and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 3CR. And we've just listened to a song, Hold Strong, by Maisha. And up next, we are going to be speaking to Farida Iqbal, who's a member of the Defend Dissent Coalition. Regular listeners of Tuesday Breakfast may remember that we first spoke to the Defend Dissent Coalition back in March before their first rally, in which we spoke to Kath. But yeah, today we're speaking to Farida, who's been involved in activism for over 25 years and has previously been part of a similar campaign to defeat anti-protest laws in Western Australia. And Farida is committed to fighting for the rights particularly of people with long COVID as a person with long COVID herself. And Frieda joins us today to chat about this proposed protest legislation, which has been tabled by the Victorian government with a focus on the potential impact of that ban on the use of face masks in protests. But thank you so much for joining us today on Tuesday Breakfast, Frieda.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for getting up early. But yeah, can you start off, particularly for those who, you know, aren't super aware of who the Defend Dissent Coalition are, yeah, what is the coalition and what are some of the key aims of the movement?
Well, it's the coalition is, yeah, it's a coalition. It's lots and lots of different groups who've come together to fight these anti-protest laws. And, yeah, it comprises groups from the environmental movement, from the trade union movement, from, yeah, transgender activists to, yeah, people like me fighting for people with long COVID and people with disabilities, all sorts of different groups. And the Free Palestine movement too, of course. And, yeah, we just came together when the anti-protest laws were first announced in the media earlier this year.
Yeah, awesome. It sounds like, yeah, such a comprehensive movement, yeah, bringing together a lot of people, you know, who are fighting for so many different issues across, yeah, you know, so many different civil society subjects. But, yeah, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what these proposed laws look like and how they would actually impact protests in Victoria?
Well, there's a few things. The thing that I'm focused on, of course, is that they're proposing to ban face masks at protests. I guess we'll talk a bit about that later, but that is just ridiculous when the COVID pandemic is still going on. And, they use that as a means to crack down on protests in general too, like pick on the people with face masks as a means to break up the demo. Similarly, they want to target... there's already this thing called a list of official terrorist organisations that are banned, and so the state government is talking about increased powers to ban the symbols of the organisations that it deems terrorist organisations. Problems with that is like some of the organisations on that list Who's to say if that's a terrorist organisation or a legitimate national liberation movement, and who is the Australian government to decide that? Say one person, waves a Hezbollah flag, say, at a Palestine rally, like could the police then use that as an excuse to bust up the whole rally, that sort of thing. Another aspect of it is they are talking about introducing increased powers to crack down on what they call dangerous attachment of devices. Essentially, any contraption or anything that people might use to lock on to equipment or to whatever. Sometimes in protests, people attach themselves to things to shut down like mining equipment or try to stop mining that the community or like logging that the community doesn't want from going ahead. People will lock onto things, and there's talking about increased powers against that too. And like really, there's already existing laws that deal with a lot of this kind of thing. There isn't a need to for more legislation to crack down on protests.
It really sounds like also, there's so many different parts to this legislation as well that will impact so many, you know, aspects of protest and so many different types of and approaches to protest as well. That, as you also explained as well, you know, there's so many groups coming together who do feel like they would be impacted by this legislation. Would you be able to speak a little bit to, what's the background to the government actually introducing this legislation?
Well, really, I think like the further background is they have been introducing
more repressive laws against protests for a while now. In 2017, they passed a raft of horrible laws about designated zones. That's a whole other kettle of fish, though. I won't go into that. But just to let the context is that they've been there's been an increased push before this year. But, when the Free Palestine movement started really, rising up against the Gaza genocide, the government has been throwing all sorts of things at that movement, and this is just part of that. And, when they first started talking about these laws earlier this year, that was in response to the, Free Palestine movement. And now, more recently, with we've probably all seen in the media, the media is whipping up a moral panic about so-called rising anti-Semitism, which, really, they're referring to basically just anti-genocide protesting. They're trying to paint that as anti-Semitism, and there's been a big media furor about that. And the government has just formed a new anti-hate task force, ostensibly about anti-Semitism, but really about suppressing the Palestine movement. And now the anti-protest laws are in the media again, and we think they're trying to get them through probably next month, which is why we've called a rally for the 12th of August. And they've also been doing in private consultations with a consultation process with NGOs. Really, they should be doing a public consultation process about this. The public, this is something that impacts the whole public, really. Anybody who has a right, who has a reason to protest, which is really all of us in the current political climate of the cost of living crisis, housing crisis, et cetera. We all have reason to protest. We have a right to be at least consulted. Really, these laws shouldn't go through at all.
I think you're so right that, everybody's impacted by, restrictions on protest. It, goes beyond, as you're saying, just NGOs. It includes every person, in our society. And, in terms of the potential negative impacts on our right to protest, there's specifically this impact of, restrictions to face masks. Can you talk a little bit more about that and, how it impacts people with disabilities and also, what the impact will have on public health and safety?
So I'll speak first from my personal situation. Like, I've had a 2.5 year long battle with long COVID. It's been the worst experience of my life. It's been nothing else in my life has been comparably traumatic. And in the same sense that someone who's been beaten up doesn't want to be beaten up again, I don't want to ever get COVID again. And if I can't mask in public, then I'm shut out of public life, and that's the situation of a lot of people with long COVID and related disabilities like ME/CFS or fibromyalgia or that sort of thing. If we can't mask in at protest, then we can't protest. And a lot of us don't. We have reduced capacity to cope with stress as well. Because our fight or flight response is out of whack. It's hard for us to cope with police getting in our face about our mask. The government has said that they will provide exemptions for people with health conditions. We don't trust the police on that. Because they are already actually cracking down on people who are masking at protests, especially at the trans rights protests. They seem to particularly be targeting that movement over masking. Maybe because trans people are at elevated risk of long COVID, so there's more people masking in those protests in general than in other protests. So the police tend to really go for the trans protests in masks, and they're doing that under the 2017 legislation, how much worse is it going to be when they, if they introduce new anti-masking legislation? So that's the impact on people with disabilities. But it's important to understand it's not just, this is not just an issue for us, because COVID actually, even though people have been lulled into a false sense of security about it, we in the long COVID community know this is a very, very serious disease. And 5% of the world has long COVID now, and it's only taken 5 years for that to happen. Hundreds of millions of people have died. And, yeah, the COVID pandemic is ongoing. It's a leading cause of deaths in Australia. And everybody has a right to protect themselves against this very dangerous virus. And so whether or not you have a health condition, people have a right to protect themselves against COVID. And, so face masks in a pandemic situation absolutely should not be banned. And they absolutely should not be used. Banning them should not be used as a means to crack down on protest.
Yeah. I think you've really outlined, Frieda, just how much this impacts people who have disabilities, and also people who are in the wider community, and just how much of a threat this is, and the threat to public safety, and also to the right to protest as well. In terms of the campaign moving forward, how can our listeners get more involved, and what's next for the campaign?
So we have our rally on the 12th of August at 5:30 p.m. Outside Parliament House. And so, we really encourage everybody to attend, because this is when these laws are likely to go to Parliament, to stand a chance of, fighting back against these laws. We've got to turn up in numbers. It's very important. So there's that date. There's also just, turning up to protests in general at the moment is important too. Not just because of this, but because of everything that's going on in the world. We establish our right to protest by exercising it, right? So turn up to as many protests as you can, and especially please come to the one on the 12th that we're organising. Also, if you want to get involved in the Defend Coalition, I guess you can send a message to the Instagram account. And, we have regular meetings, and we're going to have a lot of work to do in the lead up to the rally, like with postering, leafleting, etc. Get in touch if you want to help with that. And also we have posters printed up already. I think they should be at Friends of the Earth and Black Spark if you want to just go there and pick up some posters and stick them up.
I think that's really helpful for people to know how they can get involved, and I think certainly it sounds like the 12th of August is going to be a really big date next month. But we really appreciate you coming on air today, Frieda, and sharing more about the Defend Dissent Coalition, and what you're up to, and particularly the importance of protecting the right to wear face masks in protests.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well, we've been speaking to Frieda Iqbal from the Defend Dissent Coalition, and Frieda was chatting to us about the movement and, what those proposed legislation restricting protests would look like, and particularly the impact with bans on face masks and how that would impact public health. And you can find out more at Defend Dissent Coalition on Instagram.
Thank you so much, Juliet and Frieda. Incredibly insightful and, very timely. You are listening to 3CR Community Radio on 855 AM. Up next, we are going to speak to Sarah Barini about the convergence on Canberra. On the 20th of July, this Sunday, there will be a national rally at the Parliament House in Canberra with Palestine liberation groups and allies from across the country coming together to pressure the Labour government to end its support and complicity in the genocide. This Conversion Canberra represents a united call to sanction the State of Israel in response to the genocide. We are joined today by Sarah Barini, a NAM-based activist and organiser within the Free Palestine Movement. She is an immediate past executive member of the Islamic Council of Victoria. Good morning, Sarah. Welcome to 3CR.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
No, thanks for making time. So incredibly exciting. There's quite a bit of momentum building. A nationally coordinated convergence on Canberra. What is this? Why are we doing this? And yeah, could you share more about that?
So if you've been following the news over the last 21 months, you will very much know that Israel has been committing genocide and crimes against humanity, against the Palestinian people, openly, in front of all of our eyes. We're witnessing a live stream genocide. Yeah. And the Australian government has failed to take any appropriate action to pressure its friends and allies to put an end to its atrocity crimes. Something needs to be done. We've been protesting consistently for the last 21 months. Yeah. And the Australian government has chosen to ignore community calls for action.
Yeah.
So we are going to nationally commit to going down to Canberra over 3 days and send a clear message to the Australian government that we demand that the government impose sanctions on Israel immediately as a means to pressure the Israeli government to put an end to its crime.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, that is obviously like a key demand, right? This call for sanctions. And this is something we've been consistently calling for in the movement. So even, what do you think is the role of sanctions, I guess? Because it is obviously debated and they've put sanctions against individuals, but this is quite different, right? We are demanding for sanctions against a state, an entity. What do you think is the role of sanctions in relation to human rights and international relations?
Yeah. So, look, sanctions are a perfect way for states to put pressure on other states and individuals as well to put an end to crimes and injustices and particularly violations under international law. Now, sanctions are not something that the Australian government has never done before.
Exactly.
We do have sanctions against Russia. As of February this year, the Australian government actually imposed 1,400 sanctions on Russia.
Oh, okay.
Sanctions are not something that is completely out of the question that the Australian government has never done before.
Yeah.
It's something that we have done repeatedly against multiple states, and there's absolutely no reason why the Australian government can't impose sanctions on Israel now for the crimes that we are witnessing before our eyes. And it's very clear that the Israeli government is resistant to putting an end to its crime.
Yeah.
The Australian government has fallen to only using basically lip service words, and it's abundantly clear that words are not enough. We
Absolutely.
Need action,
yeah.
And the first step would be to impose sanctions on Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. And the International Court of Justice, the UN General Assembly have made clear that sanctions against Israel, the regime of genocide and apartheid is an obligation. So it's an obligation under international law, right? It's not.
Correct.
It's not an option. It's not. Yeah.
And the ICJ has made it very clear that it is the responsibility of states to put pressure to prevent genocide. And Australia has failed to do that. So under international law, we are failing to meet our obligation.
Exactly.
And as citizens and voters, we shouldn't accept that our government is failing to meet its obligations under international law. It's our duty as human beings and as voters to pressure the government and request them to do the right thing here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that. I was reading about the BDS movement, right? Because I think we talk a lot about BDS, and obviously we do a lot in terms of the boycotting and the divesting, but the S in BDS stands for sanctions, right? And it is, and it was interesting because when I read on the BDS page, they specifically said that it intentionally comes after BND, because it does require this like critical mass, right? This building of people power. Yeah. In order to actually push for our policymakers to fulfill those obligations. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I guess the convergence on Canberra. What do you think, why has it been so hard to push for these sanctions against Israel? Because obviously, as mentioned, there's been sanctions against Israeli settlers in the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
But why is it as an entity? So like you said, we've done it against Russia, but why is it so hard to come by when it comes to Israel?
Yeah. Unfortunately, Israel is considered Australia's friend and ally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we all know that Israel is also a close friend and ally of the United States of America, yeah. which is also an ally of Australia as
exactly.
well.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
unfortunately, it's easy to criticize those who are not your friend, and harder to criticize those who are closest to you, unfortunately. And yeah, so yeah. we've seen this repeated reluctance from the Australian government to take any action exactly. against Israel at all. I mean, even very early on, since the escalation, there was reluctance to see the Australian government even criticise the atrocities
yeah, exactly.
that Israel
yeah.
was committing. So that's reflective of the relationship that Australia unfortunately has with a genocidal regime.
Mm-hmm.
But we as a community, we need to stay firm and we need to continue to call the government, regardless of its ties, regardless of how it views Israel as a friend and ally, that shouldn't stop the Australian government from demanding justice
and
for standing and taking action in accordance with international law.
Absolutely. I mean, friends don't let friends kill other people.
Exactly.
It's not a good look. I think, yeah, so the convergence on Canberra, I guess it's, you know, a culmination of, you know, all this, like you said, almost 2 years of pressure. Could you share more, just, I guess, yeah, what is happening over the 3 days? Because it starts on Sunday, am I right? And then goes on till Tuesday.
Yeah.
Could you just share more about that?
Yeah, of course. So we're going to be heading down for a rally on Sunday, the 20th of July.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a protest at 2 o'clock outside of Parliament House in Canberra. Then we'll be marching down to the Israeli embassy.
Yeah.
And obviously we'll be clearly demanding sanctions throughout. Then Monday, the 21st of July, will be a national planning day. We'll have a few workshops.
Okay.
And things like that, and really trying to provide a space for people to strategize and come together. It'll be a nice space where we've got people from different states from across the country coming together. So we're really hoping that people can build the network and continue to coordinate nationally beyond the convergence.
Yeah.
If people want more information about the sessions that are going to be run, they can visit our website, sanctionisraelnow.com,
mm-hmm.
And there's an events tab that will have more details in relation to the program on the Monday.
Yeah.
And then on Tuesday, we're hoping to have a nice and big rally outside of Parliament House.
Yeah.
That will be on the day of the opening of Parliament.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then hopefully at some point during the day, we'll march down to the U.S. Embassy as well.
Incredible.
We've got a great lineup of speakers from different organizations and different states. We're really trying to build that national movement and momentum. So we hope as many people as possible can come down. We've got at this moment over 128 different groups from across the country have endorsed the action.
Amazing.
So we're really hoping that community shows up in numbers
yes.
and really shows the strength. Like, the numbers to me is what's more important than the speakers.
Yeah,
I think we need, like, just having the community presence.
Yeah.
Being able to stand in front of Parliament House and show our numbers is loud enough, I think.
Absolutely, it'll be powerful. Yeah, yeah.
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 So we're really hoping that community show up and support us and support the Palestinian people by turning up in Canberra
Whenever they can, obviously not everybody's going to be able to make all 3 days.
Yeah, yeah.
But if they can show up to at least the Sunday or the Tuesday, that would be incredible. We need as many people as possible to come and make it very clear to the Australian government that the Australian people stand with Palestine, they stand for Palestinian justice, and they demand that the Australian government impose sanctions immediately.
Absolutely, so beautifully and well said, Sarah. Thank you so much. And I think, yeah, and I think after all these weeks of protesting and demonstrations, you know, in our own states individually, it'd be so beautiful to witness, you know, that coming together in front of Parliament. And I really, really look forward to, to Tuesday. Really, I'm quite excited for it. So thank you so much, Sarah. Thanks for coming on, and speak thank to you, you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye bye. That was Sarah Barini speaking about the upcoming Convergence on Canberra. For more details, as she mentioned, check out at Sanction Israel Now on Instagram, as well as sanctionisraelnow.com for further details of the 3 days of action.
So we have come to the end of our program for today. So just before we give you a rundown on what we had on today's program, we just wanted to let you know that there are a couple of events in the community today in Naam. So at 11 a.m., well, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. today at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre, The Torch, in collaboration with QVWC, are putting on a collaborative weaving session as part of their running exhibition, We Weave in Circle. So people are welcome to join exhibiting artists Nans and Sonia for this weaving session. So again, that's today from 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre. And then tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. Solidarity Hall at Trades Hall, there is an event put on by NIBS in collaboration with the Migrant Workers Centre and the Search Foundation. It's a seminar with Panos Theodoropoulos on organising migrants in precarious environments. So a couple of events that are on today, so please feel free to check them out if you're free and keen. But before we leave you today, just wanted to give you a quick rundown on what we had on today's show. So we started with a two-part conversation with Renee Ha from Stamped Zine, which is a project made by migrants for migrants, documenting the complex experience for visa holders in this country.
And then at 7:45, we were joined by Isabel Renicke from Greta Fund, speaking about the Australian climate case, a landmark case about determining that the government owes a duty of care to protect Torres Strait Islanders.
And then at 8 o'clock, we spoke to Farida Iqbal from the Defend Dissent Coalition about proposed protest legislation in Victoria and the particular impact of the ban of face masks that's been proposed as well.
And finally, at 8:15, we were joined by Sarah Barini speaking about the Convergence on Canberra that will take place this Sunday through to next Tuesday.
So that's all we have for you on today's show. If you missed out on any of the interviews or discussions, or would like to follow up any of the links or documents that we mentioned in today's program, you can listen back to our show later today by going to 3cr.org.au/Tuesday-breakfast for the podcast. And that's where you can access all older editions of Tuesday Breakfast as well. Stay tuned because Accent of Women is coming up next, and make sure you stay tuned to 3CR from 7 a.m. every day this week for the other breakfast shows. Thank you, Julia and Fiza, joining us this morning. We will be back next Tuesday at 7 a.m. for another breakfast show. But for now, have a great day, and we will speak to you all next week.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.